was your reaction to the news you were going to be sent south?
Well, of course, I was sort of the bits in a way until I found what I had to do. It went quite well. I went out, I sailed with Trapassi on the 1st of January, 47, and we would cross the Drake Passage, which is normally Drake Strait, you know, the south of Cape Horn, normally considered a rotten area. With Trapassi, we went across in fine style. It was a nice, good breeze, so we had all sails set. Trapassi did use sails as well as engines. And we made good progress, got to the South Shetlands, and went into Deception. Now, this was the first shock, was when we got to Deception, because Deception had been off the air, out of radio contact with the outside world for 4 or 5 months, I think. And everybody had assumed it had just been a wireless failure, which was quite likely. It turned out that the hut had burned down and been completely destroyed, and the two men, the foremen in the base, had had to sort of survive in one of the old whalers' huts, which they'd managed to sort of convert into a reasonable living quarters. And fortunately, they had plenty of fuel and food, so they weren't too bad, but they were a bit scruffy in that they hadn't got any clothing or bedding to save. And they weren't exactly sort of clean and tidy and everything. Anyhow, we did the best we could for them, and two of them said they were due to stay on for another year down in the Antarctic. They had signed on a 2-year contract, but they said after this experience they weren't going to. So now I left Deception. We left on time, but when I was now 2 men short.
Were the men who'd had that experience, were they demoralised? Were they deflated by it? What would you assess? How would you assess their psychological condition when you found
out? I mean, it'd be wrong to say they demoralised or anything, but they'd obviously had a traumatic experience having their hut burned down, and they just weren't prepared to stay on for another 2 years. Actually, they did have, in some ways, and I only say in some ways because I don't necessarily support it myself, but they did have a valid argument. No effort had been made to find out what had gone wrong, and ships could have got into Deception. We could have sent down some sort of ship, I mean a Chilean tugboat or something like the Yelcho, could have gone there. Oh, a couple of months before we got there, because Deception is not all that difficult to reach if the ice was, and that year the ice was fairly free. So they did feel that they'd been badly done by in that nobody had come to see what had happened to them. I think that rather than say they were demoralised, they were disgruntled, and they just were not going to stay for another year.
You try to persuade them? Or was it a hopeless cause?
Well, I think it was more or less a hopeless cause. I mean, after all, men have got to be free to choose. I said that they could go, as indeed they were, due to go to a sledging base, which is the thing that all of us wanted to do, was go to a sledging base. And I knew that they could do because they were scheduled to go to a sledging base. But that didn't appeal to them. They said no, they'd like to go home after it. So
your manpower was somewhat rearranged by that, was it?
Well, I was 2 men short by now, but that, or at least the expedition was 2 men short, not John Huckle. The expedition was going to be 2 men short for the next year. However, we went on. Lockroy, everything was all right and in order. They were perfectly ready and they'd done a good job. And we went on, and we were literally in Lockroy only a few hours. And then we went on to the Argentine Islands. Now there, the conditions were slightly different because the creek leading up to the base hut was fast ice. In other words, it was absolute solid ice, probably a metre thick, something like that. And Trapassi, which was about 400-ton Newfoundland sealing vessel built of Greenheart, she was very sturdy, and Burden, her skipper, was extremely adept at handling ice, and he broke a passage up this creek. It took us quite a long time, because although we only had about a mile to do to break through the ice, you had to break off a pan of ice, put a claw onto it, tow it away out of the creek, then go back and break off another pan and keep on doing this until you got round the corner. When we got round the corner, you might say, well, what my Welsh neighbours here would say, look you, there it is, gone. Because that was what we found we'd got. The hut had gone. There was no hut exactly where it should be. And when we got there, up to where it should be, we went ashore, we found the ring bolts which had been holding the hut, where the wires had gone over the top of the hut. The ring bolts in the rock was... Sorry about that. The ring bolts were still in the rock, but the wires had gone completely, carried away, and the... There was no sign of the hut at all, no wreckage, no nothing. The only thing that was there, still half buried in the ice, was a Newfoundland dory which had been left there beside the hut. Other than that, there was absolutely nothing. And, of course, I reported this on the radio. We hadn't got walkie-talkie, I could only do it by WT. And sent the message to Clifford and, of course, to Bingham, who was the commander of the expedition down in Stonington. And he actually said, stupid young lieutenant, he doesn't know where to look. Tell him he's got to search the islands for the hut. He's obviously looking in the wrong place. The fact that we'd found the tie-down points rather than sort of knocked that one on the head. But anyhow, the next day we did a complete search of the islands, and obviously there would be no hut. Clifford, meanwhile, said, well, you've got to do the best you can, because we want to occupy these islands before the foreigners arrive, the intruders arrive, get some timber from somewhere or other and build them up, or build up a hut. So I went back to Lockroyd, knocked down half the hut there. And again, you see, this is the thing which I don't think is generally known, that I was told to get timber as quickly as possible and build a hut. So I knocked down half the big hut at Lockroyd and took that down and built a small hut at the Argentine Islands. And then when we got some sort of hut at the Argentine Islands, I went back to Deception again with Trapassi and knocked down a bit of the old whaling station. I was on a real tour of destruction this time. And took that down to the Argentine Islands and built that up, or added to what was already there. And at that stage, we'd got the whole thing sort of reasonably set up. Then, after we'd got the Argentine Islands reasonably set up, my orders were to go back to Deception to meet Jimmy Wordy, who was coming out with the Fitzroy. And he was going to take over from me and carry on the voyage of the Trapassi down to Stonington Island, which they hoped would be open by that time. Anyhow, I got back to Deception, and there was a message for me to say that the Fitzroy, which was bringing Jimmy Wordy down, was delayed, and I had time to go and do a reconnaissance of Admiralty Bay, which was one of the sites that Clifford wanted surveyed as soon as possible for a possible base site. And we did a quick recce of Admiralty Bay and then went back to Deception and stole a whaler's hut from the beach at Deception. You see, my destructive tour continued. It was literally one of these small whaler's huts. And we transported that to Admiralty Bay and stuck it up near the beach there and stuck two men in it and said, well, here's some food and best of luck, mate. We'll come back sometime or other. I mean, things were actually pretty chaotic in those days. And then we got a message that the Fitzroy was now making for Hope Bay and not Deception. So we went across from Admiralty Bay to Hope Bay, where I met Wordy and was able to transfer myself from Trapassi to the Fitzroy. And then Wordy said, well, look, we're desperately short of men now. I don't think he was too happy about the fact I'd stuck two men on Admiralty Bay. And he said, we're desperately short of men. If I can persuade Clifford to let me have you, will that be all right? Well, of course, I mean, it was obviously all right with me. I was overjoyed at the prospect of being left south. So Clifford was approached by Wordy, who said, well, I've got to have more men. And John Huckle says he'll stay down. So then they took me back to Lockroy and dropped me there. But I was dropped with one Falkland Islander, that was Jimmy Smith. And Jimmy and I then remained at Lockroy for the rest of the summer months. And we're talking about from the end of January through to, middle of April, I suppose it was.
It was around this time that you came into contact with your first protest note, is that right?
Yeah. Well, yes.
Where was it?
It was when Jimmy and Smith and I were at Lockroy, you see, and we had no radio, bare minimum food, practically speaking, no clothing, whatever. I'd got my naval uniform, and I'd got an army battle dress and a submarine sweater, which wasn't from my service in submarines. It was part of the issue down in the Antarctic. Jimmy Smith had his army battle dress and submarine sweater, and we both had army ski boots. And that was about all we had in the way of clothing. And we didn't have all that much food because everything had been moved down to the Argentine Islands. And then from there, as much as possible that was left was going to be transferred to Stonington Island when the ship finally got to Stonington. But Jimmy and I were left holding the fort at Lockroy. And then one morning, remember, we had no knowledge of what was going on. We didn't even have a radio receiver, so we couldn't receive any messages or anything. And one morning we heard the thump, thump, thump of a ship's engine coming round the headland, and we hoped it would be the Trapassi, so we went dashing out. And when we got outside, we found it was it was an Argentinian warship. But let's get this absolutely plain. It was, in fact, a Norwegian whale catcher, which had been chartered by the Argentinian Navy, and it was wearing the Argentinian naval ensign. So it was, in fact, a warship. But it was the most minor warship that's ever existed. Well, anyhow, when the It was George Pisani Riley was the lieutenant in the Argentinian Navy who came ashore. And no, I'd been told if the Argentinians or Chileans arrive, you're to deliver a protest. But nobody had explained what I had to do to deliver a protest. I just had to deliver a protest. No wording or anything was given to me. Anyhow, I sort of met this chap and said, these are British Crown lands and British territorial waters. You're only supposed to enter these lands with the permission of the governor of the Falkland Islands. I haven't been notified that you've received such permission. Actually, I couldn't have been notified because I haven't got any bloody radio still. I didn't tell him that. I haven't been notified that you've received such permission, so I must ask you to leave as soon as convenient. Of course, if you're in need of help of any sort, I shall assist you. And he sort of was quite polite in reply, and he said, but I have to tell you that these are Argentinian lands and I do not require any permission to be here. However, if you will put your protest into writing, I will take it to my senior officer and he will give you a formal response. So I did type out on the old Remington typewriter, which is still in the Port Lockroy hut of historic interest, I typed out the first, and I think it is the first official protest that was ever made about the Argentinos intruding onto British territory.
And you had to make it up?
I had to make it up, well, yes. Actually, apparently it was all right. I did the right things. I got the wording more or less right. And a few days later, I received a letter back from their sort of mini-admiral, very courteous, and it was addressed to Don Juan Huckle, which made me feel great. I'd love to be a Don. He was very courteous, but had pointed out that as these were Argentinian lands, he had no need to get any permission to be there, and that, in fact, I should have asked before I came to live there. So, well, en passe. That was the end of that. Well, obviously, the whale catcher, Don Samuel, which was... That was the name of the whale catcher, Don Samuel. She was obviously working near Port Lockroy, but we didn't know where. And nobody would say, the Norwegian crew didn't say, and the Argentinos didn't say, but she was doing something, because she'd sail early in the morning and come back fairly late in the evening. And... then one day she went away for a fair time, and Jimmy Smith and I thought, oh, she's away for a couple of days, perhaps she'll be away tomorrow, and if it's fine, we'll row round Dume Island, which is a little island near Port Lockroy. When I say little island, it was a fair-sized island. And Jimmy and I sort of set off early in the morning with what sort of emergency stock as we could make, and we went round the island and we saw at the southern end the Argers were building a little light beacon. We didn't actually go up to it because we were getting pushed for time and had to get home, and we weren't very sure of how the tides were running in the channels there. We went up the belt, went out down the Neumar and up the Beltier channel. And we got back into the house. Oh, incidentally, there were three of us there. There was a sheepdog named Crown. He'd been left by one of the previous citizens at Port Lockroy the year before, and he said, would I like him, when he was leaving? And we'd got this dog. Well, the dog was very pleased to see Jimmy and I back on that occasion. Anyhow, that was the story of that one. The next big event from that angle was the arrival of the Chilean warship Angamos. She was quite a big thing. She was a big depot ship. And we had a Commodore, a Chilean Commodore Admiral. He came ashore with a living great staff, sort of about 10 or a dozen men. And I met him. And the Argies were back in port again, the Don Samuel was back. So the Argentinian officer was also ashore, and the Chilean chap arrived, and I sort of met him and saluted him and said welcome to him, but I'm afraid I have to point out to you that you're not supposed to be here without permission, you see, and read the riot act to him. I'd already learned, don't know whether I ought to say this, but I'd already learned from reading ciphers, which I shouldn't have been reading, that in fact we were to treat the Chileans a bit more leniently than the Argies, because the Chileans weren't really sort of trying awfully hard to take our territory. So I was sort of reasonably polite with him, but anyhow, when I said that these were British Crown lands and he said they're Chilean lands, the Argie, who was standing beside us, stepped forward and said, "Gentlemen, you're in error. These are Argentinian lands." I thought, oh, bugger this for a game of soldiers. And I did the usual thing of saying, well, we can't settle anything here. And I said to the Chilean Commodore, "Would you like to come up to the hut and have a drink with me?" And he immediately said yes. And I thought, oh, God, if he brings that staff of even half a dozen of them, let alone 10 or a dozen, I've only got half a bottle of whiskey left. It won't go very far. But fortunately, he only brought an interpreter with him, and the interpreter got a very small drink. The Commodore got a bit more, and I had a drop. So we did manage to have a drink. And that night, the Chileans invited Jimmy Smith, who was with me, and I for a party on board the Angamos. And we really did have a really first-rate party. I suppose politically I shouldn't have done, but we did have a first-rate party. And it was quite interesting because it was made more sort of, well, in a way more memorable, because the captain of the Angamos, not the Commodore, the captain, had actually been a submariner. So he and I had a bit in common. We were sitting together at the meal, and we had quite a chat about how to handle submarines and things.
Did you? You're alluding there to a difference in temperature between the British relationships with Chile and the British relationships with Argentina. Is that accurate, that the Argentinians were more of a threat?
I think at that stage they certainly were, because the Argentinos were absolutely... You see, the Argentinos claimed the Falklands as well. The Chileans never claimed the Falklands, but they did claim the Antarctic. So there was a difference in what they were claiming to start with. And one has to be fair about this. The Argentinos from the 1830s onwards never let up their claim to the Falklands. They always persisted that the Falklands belonged to Argentina. And it was only the British public who didn't know this. Anyhow,
so relations with the Chileans are more cordial, but you are guilty, I gather, of kissing an Argentinian officer.
Ah, this was later, though. This was much later, and I didn't kiss him, he kissed me. But... Well, actually, we can just cut this section now. I don't want to go on forever pontificating about... My first year down south was really sort of almost a... Sorry about that. Almost a complete waste of time. I did practically speaking, no useful scientific work at all. I think the only thing I did was I rewrote the International Ice Reporting Code. Other than that, I did absolutely nothing except protest and protest and protest. After we shut down Lockroy at the end of the season in April, I went to Deception Island as base leader, and there the Argentinos, and later the Chileans came in, but the Argentinos were determined to build a base. So we had a lot of protesting to do with the Argentinos, and I did the best I could to keep it on a fairly friendly sort of basis, and in general it was. The Argentino officers were under strict orders not under any circumstances to seek help from the British. I happen to know this was their orders. They were not to seek our help. Equally, I suppose I was beholden to give them help and try and make political advantage out of it, but I used to think that's ridiculous. Our claim to the Antarctic is worth far more than just helping an RG or not, you know, an odd RG sailor or something. Anyhow, the story you were talking about, kissing an RG, came about at the almost at the end of my time in Deception, when I was really getting cheesed off with all this political work and not being able to do anything sort of my true role. An RG launch came across to the whale station one day where we were living, and when it drew up, and I noticed that there was an Argentinian officer in, well, what amounted to his best uniform. Oh, what the hell's he come here for? So we all trooped down to the jetty to find out what they wanted. And he came ashore and he announced that he'd brought back my bandera. Now, bandera's flag. And the Argies put a great deal of store in their flags. I mean, you know... We tend not to make a great deal of fuss about the Union Jack and things, but the Argies were really sort of red hot on their flag, and he got one of our flags. And I thought, that's impossible. I had a quick look at the hut, and our flag was still flying there, so I mean, this is ridiculous. How can he have one of our flags? And he produced this flag, and I looked at it, and I stood, I thought, well, that's very odd. It's a very tattered old flag. What does he mean it's our flag? And he said one of his sailors had taken it from our little tent depot on Mount Bond. And then it rang through my mind. I'd left a tent up on the lower slopes of Mount Bond just in case any parties were up on Mount Bond and sort of got caught with the weather or anything, and sort of about halfway down was this tent. It was a good position. And in it, I'd left a sleeping bag and a bit of food and primer stove and things. And my sleeping bag, which I'd left in there, had this rolled up old, tattered old remnant of a flag, which had been battered to death flying in the wind and was quite unsuitable for flying anymore. I'd rolled it up and used it as a pillow in my sleeping bag. And some argy sailor had gone along and found this blooming flag. And, of course, had taken it back on the ship and said, look what I've found. And the Argy officers were horrified. He'd stolen our flag. So anyhow, they were now presenting it back to me. And they said, of course, the sailor will be most severely punished for doing this. And I thought, well, poor bloody sod. I mean, it's obvious that any sailor out like that would steal. It's not really stealing. It's just purloin an old battered flag for a souvenir. So I told this RG officer, oh, don't worry about it. It's not important. I'm not going to even report this. It's nothing, neither one thing nor the other. Any sailor might have done a thing like that. And he was obviously absolutely delighted with this response. But his reaction certainly didn't delight me, because he stepped forward like a sort of president of France bestowing the Légion d'honneur, flung his arms around me, and kissed me on both cheeks. And the chaps who were with me at the time said they watched the red rising up in the back of my neck until it got embedded in my hair. And I must admit, it was one of the most embarrassing things that had ever happened to me in my life. And it was made more embarrassing by the fact that the whole of the other four men on deception kept pulling my leg and saying, wait till the governor hears you've been kissing the arches.